Hello, I'm Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the Hawk Foundation, our many different grant programs, a little bit about our history, not nearly as much as what our guest today is going to provide. Visit our main website at www.hog.utexas.edu. So, as I've mentioned on a few other previous episodes, we are in the midst of our 75th anniversary celebration, and we've created a commemorative website called hoghistory.org, which is a far more comprehensive and rather, you know, colorful accounting of the different things that we've done over the decades. We have lately taken advantage of the storytelling value of some of the more interesting things in our archives, such as the audio tapes of The Human Condition, the radio series that the Hawk Foundation produced in the 70s and 80s, and we've been spiffing up our offices here at the Foundation. For instance, converting the big window outside our largest meeting room into a display case featuring some of our publications from over the years. But the centerpiece of our celebration is a forthcoming history by Texas A&M San Antonio Professor William Bush. It's titled Circuit Riders for Mental Health, The Hawk Foundation and the Transformation of Mental Health in Texas. It explores the Hawk Foundation's central role in transforming the way that we think, talk, and make policy about the issue of mental health in Texas, with an emphasis on the Foundation's first three decades. And so, Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Okay. So this isn't actually among the questions that I submitted to you beforehand, but it should be a fairly simple one. Why circuit riders, and who does that apply to, and in what sense does it apply to the Hawk Foundation?
Sure. The phrase circuit riders was actually a nickname that the Foundation's staff gave themselves in their early years, because they likened themselves to the circuit riding ministers of some of the evangelical denominations of Christianity, who in the particularly in the 19th century and early 20th century U.S. Rode circuit. That is, they served multiple communities and congregations, and so they had a regular route, a circuit that they took. And the Foundation's staff performed a similar role, in particularly in the first decade of the Foundation's existence, when there really weren't any established agencies or institutions that provided any guidance or expertise on mental health around the state of Texas, and Texas being such a huge state with 254 separate counties and only about three or four staff members. They would drive around the state, often hitting, you know, three or four different locations in a single day, and giving public talks or giving expert consults to programs or to public educators in the school systems around the state of Texas. They would talk to church groups, to civic groups, to just about any group you can imagine in an unincorporated community or a town or even a mid-sized city. The founder of the foundation, or I should say the founding director of the foundation, Robert Sutherland, came from a family of ministers, and in fact his PhD officially was in Christian theology and ethics, even though he was certainly trained as a sociologist at the University of Chicago. So for a variety of reasons, I thought that was a good title for the book, because I think it describes what the foundation did in its first few decades, both physically and metaphorically.
Okay, so here's a question that I'm almost too embarrassed to ask anybody around here. You know, my esteemed colleagues. I'll ask you instead. So,
okay.
Our 75th anniversary has actually spanned 2 years. We began it last year, 2015. And from what I understand, this is owing to some uncertainty about the actual date of our founding. And so in your own opinion, as a historian, exactly how old are we? And what in your mind marks the true beginning of the Hogg Foundation? Because it was a kind of drawn out process.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you a historian's answer, which is probably going to be a little less definitive than maybe you're looking for here. But I think the ambiguity arises out of the fact, as you've suggested, that there were various stages in the foundation's birthing, if you will. So I like to think of it as spanning the period from about the summer of 1940 through the spring of 1941, or roughly analogous to an academic year that goes, you know, from the fall to through the spring. So we are really in the midst of that 75th anniversary, even now in early March. The foundation was officially chartered, in the summer of 1940, and the first director was hired in the summer of 1940. But due to various uncertainties around the mission and the appropriate activities of the foundation in those first few months, and just some of the administrative challenges of getting a foundation off the ground, they really didn't do a whole lot in those first several months. Also, in February of 1941, the foundation held a three-day event at UT Austin that was essentially an inauguration event, an announcement of the existence of the foundation that was widely attended, not just by people from UT or from Austin, but people from all around Texas and outside of the state as well. And that, to me, is really the kind of the major kind of coming out of the foundation as an organization. So I think it's appropriate to think of it as a broad period rather than a single date like a birthday or a wedding anniversary.
I see. Okay. And so the Hogg family name is a pretty illustrious one here in Texas, and our founding matriarch, Miss Ima Hogg, in particular. And much has been written about her over the years, including a fair amount, I guess, about the Hogg Foundation. How is your book a departure from what's been done previously, and how does it, you know, correct or complete the record?
A couple of things I would say about that. So there really haven't been any book-length scholarly studies of the foundation itself. Or of state-level mental health from a historical perspective. So the historical literature on mental health more broadly tends to be national in focus. We really don't have any state-level historical studies. And then we also don't really have any book-length sort of scholarly historical studies of the foundation. We do have a lot of sort of non-scholarly books about the foundation, which are good, but don't quite go into as much depth or draw on the same breadth of source materials as a scholarly book. And then we have a few scholarly books about the Hogg family that treat the foundation kind of at the length of a book chapter. So they're good, but they're, again, the sort of the breadth and depth is not quite, I think, to the extent that this book is. I also think this book takes on several related subjects in a way that maybe earlier publications don't, such as the sort of the role of race and ethnicity in the history of the Hogg Foundation and mental health, the extent to which the foundation played a role in reforming the institutions for people with mental illness in the state, the extent to which the foundation really changed the way that people think about mental health, which is a somewhat amorphous topic, but it is something I think when you finish reading this book, you know, you'll really understand just how central a role the foundation played. And it's unusual for an organization like a mental health foundation to play such an outsized role compared to its resources and in such a large state.
Alrighty, and so I'm aware that your book is on our portfolio as one of our grants, that we're very proud to make known. But I otherwise don't know a ton about how it came about. And how did you first wind up on our radar?
Sure.
You're not a UT Austin guy. And how was the book project conceived?
That's a great question. And actually, I am kind of a UT Austin guy.
My doctorate
is from UT Austin.
And that's
where this project begins.
Well, then scratch what I said.
While I was completing my dissertation, which was on the history of race and juvenile justice in Texas, I had started to do a little bit of research into HOG because some of the activities I was chronicling in my dissertation were funded by the HOG Foundation, or the HOG Foundation had played some role. And so as a result, most of the materials I needed were in the HOG archival collection at the Briscoe Center. And some of the materials I wanted to use were here at the library that you had here at the foundation's headquarters. So I actually came here a few times and used the foundation's library. Shortly around that time, I should say, I had a vacancy on my dissertation committee. I was referred to the then director of the HOG Foundation, King Davis, as somebody that I might want to add to my dissertation committee. So I met with King Davis and we talked about my dissertation, and he joined my committee. Okay. And so for the last, I think, about 2 years of my dissertation, Dr. Davis was on my committee. We met a few times and discussed the project. We also discussed the history of the HOG Foundation. And the year after I finished my dissertation, I did a half-time postdoc here at the foundation. And I produced a short, very short internal history of the foundation. It was about 80 pages long. And at the end of that year, so this would have been spring of 2005, I had accepted a faculty position at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. At my exit interview with Dr. Davis, he suggested that I might eventually want to return to this project on the history of the foundation and mental health. He thought there was a book in there. I actually addressed this in my acknowledgments because that's kind of where the idea came from. So at the time, I kind of shelved it, you know, as something I would work on at some point in the future. I was in the midst of turning my dissertation into a book. And so I just kind of shelved it. Then many years later, I was at Texas A&M San Antonio working on a project, and there was a book that I wanted to look at that happened to be part of the HOG monograph series that they published in the 60s and 70s that was kind of hard for me to get in San Antonio. I called Linda Frost, who had been here before when I had been here as a postdoc, and asked her if they could spare a copy of the book. And she said that they could and that they would send me a copy. That seemed to spark something, because right around that time she emailed me and asked me if we could have a phone conversation about a project that they were thinking of, which turned out to be this book project. So we had a conversation about that, and I thought it was a great opportunity for me to come back to this topic that I had been interested in before and that I already had compiled some material on. That's how it got started.
Okay, then. And so, I mean, I've been here for about 3 years and 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And from day one, I've had it drilled into me, I mean, not that I didn't already know, that the HOG Foundation is at bottom a grant-making foundation. And then this is sort of taken for granted in pretty much everything, how we talk about ourselves,
mm-hmm.
how we refer to ourselves. But over the decades, we've been a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And today, you know, some of that I've gained an appreciation as compared to when I started, of just how rather complex and multifaceted we are as we operate in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So what other facets of the HOG personality does your book evidence?
Sure. Well, that's interesting characterization, because certainly the first probably 15 years of its existence, grant making was probably not the first, second, or even third most important thing the foundation did, simply because they didn't have the funds. They had a very small operating budget for most of the first couple decades of their existence. They really wouldn't have the ability to start awarding grants in a systemic way until almost the, you know, around the mid-1960s. So most definitely its primary function in its first decade was public education about mental health. They were out there, the circuit riding talks, giving consultations. They recruited all kinds of speakers from outside of Texas, including some really nationally known people, to educate the public about mental health. And what they accomplished by doing that, besides the what's obvious, is that they really created a demand in the public for better mental health services that simply did not exist. And when I say mental health services, I don't just mean sort of community-based mental health clinics or those types of services, but I mean services embedded within some of the institutions in the community, like the schools, like workplaces, like churches and religious organizations, like colleges and universities. So they really start to create a demand. And of course, mental health is defined so broadly by Ima Hogg and Robert Sutherland and the other staff at the Hogg Foundation, that it can really touch on a lot of other things, everything from public health to sort of physical infrastructure issues, depending on the communities that they worked with. What the Hogg Foundation also did a lot of was leveraging the small resources that they did have to bring other resources into the state from other foundations or other organizations. And then the other thing the foundation did do is that they were quite activist in advocating for mental health. Many times they did so behind the scenes and not very publicly. They were very careful to stay away from partisan politics, but they were not shy about supporting advocacy for mental health reforms in the legislature or in kind of in the public sphere. That really begins to change around the mid to late 1960s for a couple of reasons, one of which is that they had a bigger endowment and a larger operating budget, the proceeds from that endowment that allowed them to do a systemic grant-making operation. Another reason is, quite honestly, that all of that work they had done in the first few decades had been successful. So by the late 60s, you do have, you know, MHMR, you do have counseling services being offered in all sorts of locations where it hadn't been before. You do have a public that generally is more aware of mental health, is more aware of related issues like appropriate child rearing practices, appropriate responses to certain behaviors in the workplace or in school. So by the late 60s, that just kind of overwhelming sense of need, that void, really doesn't exist anymore. And it forces a reappraisal at the foundation of what they should be doing. And that's when it really does become largely a grant-making organization.
Okay, and so, if you could put yourself in the mind of the Hogg Foundation's founding generation, what do you think might most surprise them about how the foundation has evolved, or even the field of mental health in general, or surprise them the least?
That's a really interesting question. I would say they'd certainly be really concerned about the extent to which, as a society, not just in Texas, we are using the criminal justice system to deliver mental health services, given how much we know now. You know, Miss Ima was fond of saying that we know so much more than we put into practice, even as early as the 1940s and 50s. She would certainly be able to say that now, you know, with much more force than she could then. We do know much more than we put into practice now. So I think that would surprise them. I think they would be pleased, and this is a little bit of informed speculation, but I think they would be pleased with the recent turn towards sort of the consumer revolution in mental health, if you will, the person-first language, the involvement of consumers of mental health in planning and policy making in organizations that provide mental health services or that think about policy making on mental health. I think they would be pleased with that. So those are a couple of reactions. I'll stop there.
No, that's actually plenty. And if you want to know more about what Bill is referring to, the consumer revolution, you can find some things about that on our main website, but also even on the Hog History website. I believe that if you navigate to the section that deals more with the Hog Foundation since the 1970s, we have at least a page on that. And he's absolutely right in that it's if anything kind of driving the agenda in some ways nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so you don't fully appreciate or understand the current Hog Foundation without knowing at least a little bit about that. So I encourage everyone to check that out.
Can I say one more thing about that?
Of course.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me about the consumer revolution is that its newness, to give you a sense of its newness, that wasn't being discussed. So when I came back to this subject just 2 years ago, that was completely new to me. Even 10 years earlier, it doesn't seem to have been a huge part of what the foundation was doing yet, or even that much of a part of the kind of the national discourse on mental health. So it's still pretty fresh.
Yeah.
And exciting.
Yes. Your book contains about as much information on our first director, Robert Sutherland, who you've already mentioned, as could probably be found anywhere, I might think. And as you also mentioned, he was not a mental health professional. He was, in fact, an academic sociologist. In spite of that, he managed to be our leader for 30 years. And so, as far as you're concerned, who was he? What made him special? Why was he a fitting choice, you know, to lead the Hog Foundation during its infancy and even into its adolescence?
That's a great question. He is for me one of the most interesting figures, if not the most interesting figure in the story. Also interestingly, to give you a sense of the answer to your question, the president of UT Austin added him to the list of candidates at the time that they were doing the search for the inaugural director.
And that's so Homer Rainey.
Yeah, Homer Rainey. So the individuals who were proposed all came from the fields of psychiatry and psychology. Yeah. And they were mostly nationally or at least regionally known figures. Rainey felt that the job really called for somebody who maybe was a little bit of an outsider in those disciplines. And that might reflect in part the fact that those disciplines at the time were still closely associated with the mental hospitals and the institutions. And, within psychiatry, to be sure, there's still kind of an internal maybe struggle, disagreement going on about the direction of the field and the extent to which mental health should really be central to that field. Maybe a little bit less so in psychology. So I think for those reasons, Rainey probably thought that the directorship called for somebody who maybe was a little more interdisciplinary in orientation in terms of academics. And I think he was thinking of it from the perspective of who's going to be a good administrator, who is going to be somebody who will work well with the legislature, work well with the community, work well with private individuals. Somebody who had good people skills, somebody who could work with the various stakeholders that he suspected were going to be important to the foundation, not only surviving, but growing and thriving successfully. So I suspect that, that those are reasons why he was a good choice, as opposed to somebody who was more directly in one of the disciplines related to mental health. And I may be imposing my own judgment on the way I'm characterizing this, but I think history would suggest that that was a good choice.
Okay. When can we expect your book to be widely available?
I don't have a date yet, but I am expecting it to be widely available no later than September of this year, and possibly sooner. Okay. I'm waiting to see my page proofs anytime now, and I am hoping to get it on the program for the Texas Book Festival this fall, which is in October, and it's a wonderful event. I'm sure many listeners have gone to that event before here in Austin, and I'd be excited to be there.
Okay, well, and as you can expect, we'll be, you know, hyping it to the best of our ability. And thank you for joining us. We hope that the book brings you as many, you know, blessings as it does conversation fodder for us. And again, we very much appreciate, you know, you kind of lending your intellectual heft to our efforts to tell our story. And so, and for the podcast, too. Thanks a bunch.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.